The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 2, Side 2.
But there were also direct accusations against those present, that they had exchanged information with acquaintances who lived in outlying areas, Kiev, for example, which were not under the control of the Central Soviet authorities. In other words, this used to be Russia, let's say, but then in the interests of world revolution, we ceded this one piece to Germany. And people continued to exchange letters. How are you doing there, Ivan Ivanich? Here's how things are going with us. N.M. Kishkin, a member of the Central Committee of the Cadets, was so brazen as to try to justify himself right from the defendant's bench. A man doesn't want to be blind. He tries to find out everything he can about what's going on everywhere. To find out everything about what's going on everywhere? He doesn't want to be blind? Well, all one can say is that the accuser correctly described their actions as treason. Treason to Soviet power. But their most heinous acts were something else again. In the midst of the Civil War, they wrote books, composed memoranda and projects. Yes, as experts in constitutional law, financial science, economic relationships, the system of justice and education, they wrote works. And as one might easily guess, their works were not based on earlier works by Lenin, Trotsky and Bukharin. Professor Kotliarevsky wrote on the federal structure of Russia. V.I. Stempkovsky on the agrarian question. No doubt without collectivization. V.S. Muralevich on education in the future Russia. N.N. Vinogradsky on economics. And the great biologist N.K. Kultsov, who never received anything from the motherland except persecution and execution, allowed all those bourgeois bigshots to get together in his institute for their discussions. N.D. Kondratiev was included here also. In 1931, he was condemned once and for all in connection with TKP, the fictitious Working Peasants' Party. Our accuser's heart jumps right out of our chest, outrunning the sentence. Well, what punishment was adequate for these assistants to the general? Just one, of course, to be shot. That was not merely what the accuser demanded, it was the sentence of the tribunal. Alas, it was later commuted to concentration camp until the end of the Civil War. And indeed, the defendant's guilt consisted in the fact that they hadn't sat in their own corners sucking on their quarter pound of bread, that they had talked things over and reached agreements as to what the state structure should be after the fall of the Soviet regime. In contemporary scientific language, this is known as the study of the alternative possibility. The voice of the accuser thundered, but we hear some kind of crack in it, as if his eyes were searching the rostrum, looking for another piece of paper. A quotation, perhaps. Give it to him on tiptoe. Quick, quick. Give him one at random, from some other trial. It's not important. Wasn't this the one, Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko? For us, the concept of torture inheres in the very fact of holding political prisoners in prison. So that's it. It is torture to keep political prisoners in prison. And the accuser said so. What a generous view. A new jurisprudence is arising. And further. Struggle against the Tsarist government was second nature to them, the politicals. And not to struggle against Tsarism was something of which they were incapable. What's that? They were incapable of not studying alternative possibilities? Perhaps thinking was first nature to the intellectual. Alas, through stupidity, they had shoved the wrong quotation at him. Now, wasn't that a mix-up for you? But Nikolai Vasilievich was already off to the races. And even if the defendants here in Moscow did not lift a finger, and it looks very much as though that's the way it was, at such a moment, nevertheless, even a conversation over a teacup as to the kind of system that should replace the Soviet system, which is allegedly about to fall, is a counter-revolutionary act. During the Civil War, not only is any kind of action against Soviet power a crime, but the fact of inaction is also criminal. Well, now everything is comprehensible. Everything is clear. They are being sentenced to death for inaction. For a cup of tea. The Petrograd intellectuals, for example, decided that in the event of Yudenich's taking the city, They would first of all concern themselves with convening a democratic municipal Duma, in other words, to safeguard the city against a possible dictatorship. Krylenko, I would like to shout at them, it was your duty to think first of all how you might die in battle, so as not to allow Yudenich into the city. But they didn't die in battle. Nor, in fact, did Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko. In addition, there were certain defendants who knew about all this talk and yet kept silent, did not write denunciations. In our contemporary lingo, he knew, but he didn't tell. And here is another real example, not merely of inaction, but of actively criminal action. Through L.N. Khrushcheva, a member of the Political Red Cross, and there she was, on the defendant's bench. Some of the other defendants had raised money to help the Butyrki prisoners. One can just picture that flood of capital pouring into the prison commissary. And they had supplied various articles, too. Yes, indeed, just look. Woolens, too, perhaps. There were no bounds to their evil doing, nor would there be any limits to their proletarian punishment. As when a cinema projector starts slowing down, 28 pre-revolutionary male and female faces flicker past us in a film that's fuzzy and askew. We didn't notice their expressions. Were they frightened, contemptuous, proud? We don't have their answers. Their last words are missing because of technical considerations. But making up for this lack, the accuser croons to us. From beginning to end, it was self-flagellation and repentance for the mistakes they committed, the political instability and the interim nature of the intelligentsia. Yes, yes, here comes another one, interim nature. Completely justified that Marxist evaluation of the intelligentsia made by the Bolsheviks. I don't know. Perhaps they did engage in self-flagellation. Perhaps they didn't. Perhaps the passion to save one's life at any cost had already come into being. Perhaps the old dignity of the intelligentsia had still been maintained. I don't know. Who was that young woman flashing past? That was Tolstoy's daughter, Alexandra. Krylenko asked her, "What did you do during these conversations?" And she answered, "I attended to the samovar." 3 years of concentration camp. And who was that man over there? His face was familiar. It was Sava Morozov. But listen here, after all, he gave the Bolsheviks all that money. And now he has handed a little to these people? 3 years in prison, but released on probation. Let that be a lesson to him. He would soon cut his own throat. And that's how the son of our freedom rose. It was as just such a well-nourished little imp that our Octoberist child, Law, began to grow. Today we don't remember this at all. Chapter 9. The Law Becomes a Man. Our review has already grown, yet we have in fact hardly begun. All the big and famous trials are still ahead of us, but their basic lines have already been indicated. So let us stick with our Law while it is still in its Boy Scout stage. Let us recall one long-forgotten case which was not even political. F. The Case of Glovetop. May 1921. This case was important because it involved engineers, or as they had been christened in the terminology of the times, specialists, or spetsi. Glovetop was the main fuels committee. 1921 was the most difficult of all the four winters of the Civil War. Nothing was left for fuel, and trains simply couldn't get to the next station. And there were cold and famine in the capitals, and a wave of strikes in the factories. Strikes which, incidentally, have been completely wiped out of our history books by now. Who was to blame? That was a famous question. Who is to blame? Well, obviously not the overall leadership, and not even the local leadership. That was important. If the comrades who were often brought in from outside, that is, the communist leaders, did not have a correct grasp of the business at hand, then it was the engineers, or spetsi, who were supposed to outline for them the correct approach to the problem. And this meant that it was not the leaders who were to blame. Those who had worked out the calculations were to blame. those who had refigured the calculation, those who had calculated the plan, which consisted of how to produce food and heat with zeros. Those to blame weren't the ones who compelled, but the ones who calculated. If the planning turned out to be inflated, the Spetsi were the ones to blame. Because the figures did not jive, this was the fault of the Spetsi, not of the Council of Labor and Defense, and not even of the responsible men in charge of Glavtop, the main fuels committee. If there was no coal, firewood, or petroleum, it was because the Spetsi had brought about a mixed-up, chaotic situation, and it was their own fault that they hadn't resisted the urgent telephonograms from Rykov and the government, and had issued and allotted fuels outside the scope of the plan. The Spetsi were to blame for everything, but the proletarian court was not merciless with them. Their sentences were lenient. Of course, an inner hostility to those cursed Spetsi remains in proletarian hearts, but one can't get along without them. Everything goes to rack and ruin, and the tribunal doesn't persecute them, and Krylenko even says that from 1920 on, there is no question of any sabotage. The Spetsi are to blame, but not out of malice on their part. It's simply because they are inept. They aren't able to do any better. Under capitalism, they hadn't learned to work, or else they were simply egotists and bribe-takers. And so, at the beginning of the Reconstruction period, a surprising tendency toward leniency could be observed in regard to the engineers. The year 1922, the first year of peace, was rich in public trials, so rich that almost this entire chapter will be devoted to that year alone. People are surprised. The war has ended, and yet there is an increase in court activity. But in 1945, too, and in 1948, the dragon became very, very energetic. Is there not perhaps a simple sort of law in this? Although in December 1921 the Ninth Congress of the Soviets decreed that the authority of the Cheka be narrowed, and in consequence its authority was indeed narrowed, and it was renamed the GPU as early as October 1922, the powers of the GPU were broadened again. And in December, Dzerzhinsky told a Pravda correspondent, "Now we need to keep watch with particular vigilance over anti-Soviet currents and groupings. The GPU has reduced its apparatus but strengthened it in terms of quality." And at the beginning of 1922, we must not bypass G. The case of the suicide of engineer Oldenburger, tried before the Werktrieb, the Supreme Tribunal, in February 1922. This case is forgotten, insignificant, and totally atypical. It was atypical because its entire scale was that of a single life that had already ended, and if that life hadn't ended, it would have been that very engineer, yes, and 10 more with him, forming a centre who would have sat before the Werktrieb. In that event, the case would have been altogether typical. But as it was, an outstanding party comrade, Sidernikov, sat on the defendant's bench, and with him two members of the RKI, the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection, and two trade union officials. But like Chekhov's far-off broken harp string, there was something plaintive in this trial. It was in its own way an early predecessor of the Shakhty and Prompati trials. V.V. Oldenburger had worked for 30 years in the Moscow water supply system, and had evidently become its chief engineer back at the beginning of the century. Even though the Silver Age of Art, 4 state dumas, 3 wars, and 3 revolutions had come and gone, all Moscow drank Oldenburger's water. The acmeists and the futurists, the reactionaries and the revolutionaries, the military cadets and the Red Guards, the Council of People's Commissars, the Cheka, and the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection, all had drunk Oldenburger's pure, cold water. He had never married, and he had no children. His whole life had consisted of that one water supply system. In 1905, he refused to permit the soldiers of the guard near the water supply conduits, because the soldiers, out of clumsiness, might break the pipes or machinery. On the second day of the February Revolution, he said to his workers that that was enough, the revolution was over, and they should all go back to their jobs. The water must flow. And during the October fighting in Moscow, he had only one concern, to safeguard the water supply system. His colleagues went on strike in answer to the Bolshevik coup d'etat and invited him to take part in the strike with them. His reply was, "On the operational side, please forgive me, I am not on strike. In everything else, yes, I am on strike." He accepted money for the strikers from the strike committee and gave them a receipt, but he himself dashed off to get a sleeve to repair a broken pipe. But despite this, he was an enemy. Here's what he had said to one of the workers. "The Soviet regime won't last 2 weeks." There was a new political situation preceding the announcement of the new economic policy, and in this context, Krylenko could allow himself some frank talk before the Verkhtrib. "It was not only the Spetsy who thought that way at the time. That is what we ourselves thought more than once." But despite this, Oldenburger was an enemy. Just as Comrade Lenin had told us, "To keep watch over the bourgeois specialists, we need a watchdog, the RKI, the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection." They began by assigning two such watchdogs to Oldenburger on a full-time basis. One of them, Makarov Zemlyansky, a swindler and a former clerk in the water system, had been fired for improper conduct and had entered the service of the RKI because they paid better. He got promoted to the Central People's Commissariat because the pay there was even better, and from that height he had returned to check up on his former chief and take hearty vengeance on the man who had wronged him. Then, of course, the local party committee, that matchless defender of the workers' interests, wasn't dozing either, and communists were put in charge of the water system. "Only workers are to hold the top positions. There are to be only communists at leadership level, and the wisdom of this view was confirmed by the given trial." The Moscow party organization also kept its eyes on the water supply system, and behind it stood the Cheka. "In our own time, we built our army on the basis of a healthy feeling of class enmity. In its name, we do not entrust even one responsible position to people who do not belong to our camp without assigning them a commissar." And so they all immediately began to order the chief engineer about, to supervise him, to give him instructions, and to shift the engineering personnel around without his knowledge. They broke up the whole nest of businessmen. But they did not, even so, safeguard the water supply system. Things didn't go better with it, but worse. So slyly had that gang of engineers contrived to carry out an evil scheme. Even more, overcoming his intellectual's interim nature, as a result of which he had never in his life expressed himself sharply, Oldenburger made so bold as to describe as stupid stubbornness the actions of the new chief of the water supply system, Zenyuk. To Krylenko, a profoundly likable person on the basis of his internal structure. It was at this point that it became clear that engineer Oldenburger was consciously betraying the interests of the workers and that he was a direct and open enemy of the dictatorship of the working class. They started bringing inspection commissions into the water supply system, but the commissions found that everything was in good order and that water was being supplied on a normal basis. The RKI men, the Rabkrinovtsi, refused to be satisfied with this. They kept pouring report after report into the RKI. Oldenburger simply wanted to ruin, spoil, break down the water supply system for political purposes, but he was unable to. Well, they put what obstacles in his way that they could. They prevented wasteful boiler repairs and replacing the wooden tanks with concrete ones. At meetings of the water supply system workers, the leaders began saying openly that their chief engineer was the soul of organized technical sabotage, and that he should not be believed, that he should be resisted at every point. Despite all this, the operation of the water supply system not only didn't improve, but deteriorated. What was particularly offensive to the hereditary proletarian psychology of the officials of the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection and of the trade unions was that the majority of the workers at the pumping stations had been infected with petty bourgeois psychology, and unable to recognize Oldenburger's sabotage had come to his defense. At this point, elections to the Moscow Soviet were being held, and the workers nominated Oldenburger as the candidate of the water supply system, against whom, of course, the party cell backed its own party candidate. However, this turned out to be futile because of the chief engineer's fraudulent authority with the workers. Nonetheless, the party cell brought up the question with the district party committee on all levels and announced at a general meeting that Oldenburg is the center and soul of sabotage and will be our political enemy in the Moscow Soviet. The workers responded with an uproar and shouts of untrue lies. And at that point, the secretary of the party committee, Comrade Sedelnikov, flung right in the faces of the thousand-headed proletariat there, I am not even going to talk to such black hundred reactionary pogrom makers. That is to say, we'll talk to you somewhere else. Party measures were also taken. They expelled the chief engineer from, no less, the Collegium for Administration of the Water System, and kept him under constant investigation. Continually summoned him before a multitude of commissions and sub-commissions. Kept interrogating him and giving him assignments that were to be urgently carried out. Every time he failed to appear, it was entered in the record, in case of a future trial. And through the Council of Labour and Defence, Chairman Comrade Lenin, they got an extraordinary troika appointed to the water system. It consisted of representatives of the RKI, the Council of Trade Unions, and Comrade Kuibyshev. And for the fourth year, the water kept right on flowing through the pipes, and Muscovites kept on drinking it and didn't notice anything wrong. Then, Comrade Sedelnikov wrote an article for the newspaper Ekonomische Skyazhin. In view of the rumours disturbing the public in regard to the catastrophic state of the water mains, and he reported many new and alarming rumours, even that the water system was pumping water underground and was intentionally washing away the foundations of all Moscow, set there by Ivan Kalita in the 14th century. They summoned the Commission of the Moscow Soviet. The Commission found that the state of the water system was satisfactory and that its technical direction was efficient. Oldenburg denied all the accusations. And then Sedelnikov placidly declared, I had set myself the task of stirring up a fuss about this matter in order to get the question of the Spetsi taken up. What remained for the leaders of the workers to do at this point? What was the final infallible method? A denunciation to the Cheka. Sedelnikov resorted to just that. He painted a picture of the conscious wrecking of the water system by Oldenburg. He did not have the slightest doubt that a counter-revolutionary organization existed in the water system in the heart of Red Moscow. And furthermore, a catastrophic situation at the Rublevo water tower. At this point, Oldenburg was guilty of a tactless act of rudeness, the outburst of a spineless interim intellectual. They had refused to authorize his order for new boilers from abroad, and at the time in Russia it was quite impossible to fix the old ones. So Oldenburg committed suicide. It had been just too much for one man. After all, he hadn't undergone the conditioning for that sort of thing. The cause was not lost, however. They could find a counter-revolutionary organization without him. RKI men would now undertake to expose the whole thing. Some concealed maneuvering went on for 2 months, but such was the spirit at the beginning of the NEP that a lesson had to be taught both one side and the other. So there was a trial in the Supreme Tribunal. Krylenko was moderately severe. Krylenko was moderately merciless. He was understanding. The Russian worker, of course, was right to see in every person not of his own class someone more likely to be an enemy than a friend. Nevertheless, given the further change in our practical and general policy, perhaps we must be prepared for still greater concessions, for retreating and manoeuvring. Perhaps the party will be forced to adopt a tactical program of action which the primitive logic of honest, dedicated warriors is going to protest. Well, it's a fact. The workers who testified against Comrade Sedelnikov and the RKI men were easily brushed off by the tribunal, and the defendant Sedelnikov replied brazenly to the threats of the accuser. Comrade Krylenko, I know all those articles, but after all, no one is judging class enemies here, and those articles relate to class enemies. However, Krylenko laid it on good and thick. Deliberately false denunciations to state institutions, in circumstances aggravating guilt, such as a personal grudge and the settling of personal accounts, the abuse of an official position, political irresponsibility, abuse of power and of the authority of government officials and members of the Russian Communist Party, Bolsheviks, disorganization of the work of the water supply system, injury done the Moscow Soviet and Soviet Russia because there were few such specialists and it was impossible to find replacements for them. And we won't even begin to speak of the individual personal loss. In our time, when struggle is the chief content of our lives, we have somehow grown used to not counting these irrevocable losses. The Supreme Revolutionary Tribunal must utter its weighty word. Punishment must be assessed with all due severity. We didn't come here just to crack jokes. Good Lord, now what are they going to get? Could it really be? My reader has gotten used to prompting. All of them to be sh... And that is absolutely correct. All of them were to be publicly shamed, bearing in mind their sincere repentance. All of them to be sentenced to ostracism and ridicule. Two truths. And Sedelnikov, allegedly, got 1 year in jail. You will just have to forgive me if I don't believe it. Oh, you bards of the 20s, painting your pictures of their bright and bubbling happiness. Even those who touched only their farthest edge, who touched them only in childhood, will never forget them. And those plug uglies, those fat faces, busy persecuting engineers, in the 20s too, they ate their bellies full. And now we see also that they had been busy from 1918 on. In the two trials following, we will take leave of our favourite supreme accuser for a while. He is occupied with his preparations for the major trial of the SRs. The provincial trials of the SRs took place even earlier, such as the one in Saratov in 1919. This spectacular trial aroused a great deal of emotion in Europe beforehand, and the People's Commissariat of Justice was suddenly taken aback. After all, we had been trying people for 4 years without any code, neither a new one nor an old one. And in all probability, Krylenko himself was concerned about the code, too. Everything had to be neatly tied up ahead of time. The coming church trials were internal. They didn't interest progressive Europe, and they could be conducted without a code. We have already had an opportunity to observe that the separation of church and state was so construed by the state that the churches themselves and everything that hung in them was installed in them and painted in them, belonged to the state, and the only church remaining was that church which, in accordance with the scriptures, lay within the heart. And in 1918, when political victory seemed to have been attained faster and more easily than had been expected, they had pressed right on to confiscate church property. However, this leap had aroused too fierce a wave of popular indignation. In the heat of the Civil War, it was not very intelligent to create, in addition, an internal front against the believers. And it proved necessary to postpone for the time being the dialogue between the communists and the Christians. At the end of the Civil War, and as its natural consequence, an unprecedented famine developed in the Volga area. They give it only two lines in the official histories because it doesn't add a very ornamental touch to the wreaths of the victors in that war. But the famine existed nonetheless, to the point of cannibalism, to the point at which parents ate their own children. Such a famine as even Russia had never known, even in the time of troubles in the early 17th century. Because at that time, as the historians testify, unthreshed ricks of grain survived intact beneath the snow and ice for several years. Just one film about famine might throw a new light on everything we saw and everything we know about the Revolution and the Civil War. But there are no films and no novels and no statistical research. The effort is to forget it. It does not embellish. Besides, we have come to blame the kulaks as the cause of every famine. And just who were the kulaks in the midst of such collective death? V.G. Korolenko, in his Letters to Lunacharsky, which, despite Lunacharsky's promise, were never officially published in the Soviet Union, explains to us Russia's total epidemic descent into famine and destitution. They were published in Paris in 1922 and in the Soviet Union in Samizdat in 1967. It was the result of productivity having been reduced to zero. The working hands were all carrying guns. And the result also of the peasants' utter lack of trust and hope that even the smallest part of the harvest might be left for them. Yes, and some day someone will also count up those many carloads of food supplies rolling on and on for many, many months to Imperial Germany under the terms of the peace treaty of Brest-Litovsk, from a Russia which had been deprived of a protesting voice from the very provinces where famine would strike, so that Germany could fight to the end in the West. There was a direct, immediate chain of cause and effect. The Volga peasants had to eat their children because we were so impatient about putting up with the Constituent Assembly. But political genius lies in extracting success even from the people's ruin. A brilliant idea was born. After all, 3 billiard balls can be pocketed with one shot. So now let the priests feed the Volga region. They are Christians. They are generous. One. If they refuse, we will blame the whole famine on them and destroy the church. 2. If they agree, we will clean out the churches. 3. In either case, we will replenish our stocks of foreign exchange and precious metals. Yes, and the idea was probably inspired by the actions of the church itself. As Patriarch Tikhon himself had testified back in August 1921, at the beginning of the famine, the church had created diocesan and all-Russian committees for aid to the starving and had begun to collect funds. But to have permitted any direct help to go straight from the church into the mouths of those who were starving would have undermined the dictatorship of the proletariat. The committees were banned and the funds they had collected were confiscated and turned over to the state treasury. The patriarch had also appealed to the Pope in Rome and to the Archbishop of Canterbury for assistance. But he was rebuked for this too, on the grounds that only the Soviet authorities had the right to enter into discussions with foreigners. Yes, indeed. And what was there to be alarmed about? The newspapers wrote that the government itself had all the necessary means to cope with the famine. Meanwhile, in the Volga region, they were eating grass, the soles of shoes, and gnawing door jams. And finally, in December 1921, Pomgol, the State Commission for Famine Relief, proposed that the churches help the starving by donating church valuables, not all, but those not required for liturgical rites. The Patriarch agreed. Pomgol issued a directive. All gifts must be strictly voluntary. On February 19, 1922, the Patriarch issued a pastoral letter permitting the parish councils to make gifts of objects that did not have liturgical and ritual significance. And in this way, matters could again have simply degenerated into a compromise that would have frustrated the will of the proletariat, just as it once had been by the Constituent Assembly, and still was in all the chatterbox European parliaments. The thought came in a stroke of lightning. The thought came, and a decree followed. A decree of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee on February the 26th. All valuables were to be requisitioned from the churches for the starving. The Patriarch wrote to Kalinin, who did not reply. Then, on February the 28th, the Patriarch issued a new, fateful pastoral letter. From the church's point of view, such a measure is sacrilege, and we cannot approve the requisition. From the distance of a half century, it is easy to reproach the Patriarch. Of course, the leaders of the Christian Church ought not to have been distracted by wondering whether other resources might not be available to the Soviet government, and who it was who had driven the Volga to famine. They ought not to have clung to those treasures, since the possibility of a new fortress of faith arising, if it existed at all, did not depend on them. But one has also to picture the situation of that unfortunate patriarch, not elected to his post until after the October Revolution, who had for a few short years led a church that was always persecuted, restricted, under fire, and whose preservation had been entrusted to him. But right then and there, a surefire campaign of persecution began in the papers, directed against the patriarch and high church authorities, who were strangling the Volga region with the bony hand of famine. And the more firmly the patriarch clung to his position, the weaker it became. In March, a movement to relinquish the valuables, to come to an agreement with the government, began even among the clergy. Their still undispelled qualms were expressed to Kalinin by Bishop Antonin Granovsky, a member of the Central Committee of Pomgol. The believers fear that the church valuables may be used for other purposes, more limited and alien to their hearts. Knowing the general principles of our progressive doctrine, the experienced reader will agree that this was indeed very probable. After all, the Comintern's needs and those of the East in the course of being liberated were no less acute than those of the Volga. The Petrograd metropolitan, Veniamin, was similarly impelled by a mood of trust. This belongs to God, and we will give all of it by ourselves. But forced requisitions were wrong. Let the sacrifice be of our own free will. He, too, wanted verification by the clergy and the believers to watch over the church valuables up to the very moment when they were transformed into bread for the starving. And in all this, he was tormented lest he violate the censoring will of the patriarch. In Petrograd, things seemed to be working out peacefully. The atmosphere at the session of the Petrograd Pomgol on March 5, 1922, was even joyful, according to the testimony of an eyewitness. Veniamin announced, "The Orthodox Church is prepared to give everything to help the starving." It saw sacrilege only in forced requisition. But in that case, requisition was unnecessary. Kanachikov, chairman of the Petrograd Pomgol, gave his assurances that this would produce a favorable attitude toward the church on the part of the Soviet government. Not very likely that. In a burst of good feeling, everyone stood up. The Metropolitan said, "The heaviest burden is division and enmity. But the time will come when the Russian people will unite. I myself, at the head of the worshippers, will remove the cover of precious metals and precious stones from the icon of the Holy Virgin of Kazan. I will shed sweet tears on it and give it away." He gave his blessing to the Bolshevik members of Pomgol, and they saw him to the door with bared heads. The newspaper, Petrogradskaya Pravda, in its issues of March 8th, 9th, and 10th, confirmed the peaceful, successful outcome of the talks and spoke favorably of the Metropolitan. See the articles entitled "The Church and the Famine" and "How the Church Valuables Will Be Requisitioned." In Smolny, they agreed that the church vessels and icon coverings would be melted down into ingots in the presence of the believers. Again, things were getting fouled up with some kind of compromise. The noxious fumes of Christianity were poisoning the revolutionary will. That kind of unity and that way of handing over the valuables were not what the starving people of the Volga needed. The spineless membership of the Petrograd Pomgol was changed. The newspapers began to howl about the evil pastors and princes of the church, and the representatives of the church were told, "We don't need your donations, and there won't be any negotiations with you. Everything belongs to the government, and the government will take whatever it considers necessary." And so forcible requisitions, accompanied by strife, began in Petrograd, as they did everywhere else. And this provided the legal basis for initiating trials of the clergy. I have taken this material from Essays on the History of the Troubles of the Church by Anatoly Levitin, Part 1, Samizdat, 1962, and from the stenographic notes on the questioning of Patriarch Tikhon, Trial Record, Volume 5. H. The Moscow Church Trial, April the 26th to May the 7th, 1922. This took place in the Polytechnic Museum. The court was the Moscow Rev Tribunal under presiding Judge Beck. The prosecutors were Lunin and Longinov. There were 17 defendants, including archpriests and laymen, accused of disseminating the Patriarch's proclamation. This charge was more important than the question of surrendering or not surrendering church valuables. Archpriest A.N. Zauzerski had surrendered all the valuables in his own church, but he defended in principle the Patriarch's appeal regarding forced requisition as sacrilege, and he became the central personage in the trial, and would shortly be shot. all of which went to prove that what was important was not to feed the starving, but to make use of a convenient opportunity to break the back of the church. On May the 5th, Patriarch Tikhon was summoned to the tribunal as a witness. Even though the public was represented only by a carefully selected audience, 1922 in this respect differing little from 1937 and 1968, nonetheless the stamp of old Russia was still so deep, and the Soviet stamp was still so superficial, that on the Patriarch's entrance, more than half of those present rose to receive his blessing. Tikhon took on himself the entire blame for writing and disseminating his appeal. The presiding judge of the tribunal tried to elicit a different line of testimony from him. "But it isn't possible. Did you really write it in your own hand, all the lines? You probably just signed it. And who actually wrote it? And who were your advisers?" And then, "Why did you mention in the appeal the persecution to which the newspapers are subjecting you? After all, they are persecuting you, and why should we hear about it? What did you want to express?" The Patriarch: "That is something you will have to ask the people who started the persecution. What objectives were they pursuing?" The presiding judge: "But that, after all, has nothing to do with religion." The Patriarch: "It has historical significance." The presiding judge: "Referring to the fact that the decree was published while you were in the midst of talks with Pomgol, you used the expression, behind your back." The Patriarch: "Yes." Presiding judge: "You therefore consider that the Soviet government acted incorrectly?" A crushing argument. It will be repeated a million times more in the nighttime offices of interrogators. And we will never answer as simply and straightforwardly as the Patriarch. "Yes." The presiding judge: "Do you consider the state's laws obligatory or not?" The Patriarch: "Yes, I recognize them to the extent that they do not contradict the rules of piety." Oh, if only everyone had answered just that way, our whole history would have been different. A debate about church law followed. The Patriarch explained that if the church itself surrendered its valuables, it was not sacrilege, but if they were taken away against the church's will, it was. His appeal had not prohibited giving the valuables at all, but had only declared that seizing them against the will of the church was to be condemned. "But that's what we wanted, expropriation against the will of the church." Comrade Beck, the presiding judge, was astounded. "Which, in the last analysis, is more important to you, the laws of the church or the point of view of the Soviet government?" The expected reply: "The Soviet government." "Very well, so it was sacrilege according to the laws of the church," exclaimed the accuser. "But what was it from the point of view of mercy?" For the first and last time, for another 50 years, that banal word, mercy, was spoken before a tribunal. Then there was a philological analysis of the word sviatotatsvo, meaning sacrileged, derived from sviato, meaning holy, and tat, meaning thief. The accuser: "So that means that we, the representatives of the Soviet government, are thieves of holy things?" A prolonged uproar in the hall, a recess, the bailiffs at work. The accuser: "So you call the representatives of the Soviet government, the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, thieves?" The Patriarch: "I am citing only church law." Then there is a discussion of the term blasphemy. While they were requisitioning the valuables from the Church of St. Basil the Great of Caesarea, the icon cover would not fit into a box, and at that point they trampled it with their feet. But the Patriarch himself had not been present. The accuser: "How do you know that? Give us the name of the priest who told you that, and we will arrest him immediately." The Patriarch does not give the name. "That means it was a lie." The accuser presses on triumphantly: "No, who spread that repulsive slander?" The presiding judge: "Give us the names of those who trampled the icon cover. One can assume that after doing it they left their visiting cards. Otherwise the tribunal cannot believe you."
This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.